Hello, is this Kimberly?
Yes, it is.
Hiya, it's Nicholas here. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing just fine, thanks.
Are you okay for doing this interview?
All right, hang on just a minute. Let me look this over. I've got a week of school visits today, and I've been in there trying to reconfigure some 45-minute programs. Okay, go.
Okay, my first question is, how did you first begin writing?
I started writing the same way everybody starts writing, is you have no concept that you're actually starting to write. You just do things that you think are fun. And I think, like most people in my age group, and I'm not going to tell you what that is, but I really started writing songs. I think that's how a lot of teenagers start writing. And so I started writing as a teenager in, pop songs and things like that. And then when I was in school, I wrote for the college newspaper. And then when I got out of school, I wrote for a small newspaper. But all along, songwriting was always something that could be done. It was fairly easy. All you needed was a guitar or a piano. And so that was really how I started. And I didn't really have a sense of it as starting a writing career, but that's how it began.
Now, you've had a long and extensive career in, children's entertainment. I was wondering why you chose this area of entertainment to write for.
Well, again, I'm not sure. You start down a path, and I'm not sure how much you choose and how much of it is just you just keep following a path and you wind up somewhere. And sometimes you're just, very surprised by where you do wind up. Mainly, it was a confluence of interests and experiences and events. I went to New York. I worked for a company that produced animated television half hours for the networks. At the same time, I was continuing to write songs, and I took a songwriting workshop at Carnegie Hall. And the teacher said to me, he said, you're really trying to load more lyric craft into this format than it's designed to carry, and you're really going through you have a very narrative approach to lyric writing. I think you should think about musical theater." And I really didn't know very much about musical theater, but again, was just trying to follow the different posts and directions. And so I auditioned for a workshop in New York called the BMI Musical Theater Writers Workshop, and actually knew very little about it. But miraculously, I did get in. It's free, but you have to audition. You have to work very hard once you're in it. But that really took what I was doing very kind of naturally and then taught me a lot of craft and a lot of technique over a period of 3 years. And at the same time, in my day job, I'm working on animated television shows as a production assistant. And after a period of time, I left that job. And because I had a background in animation and they were looking for animation writers in New York, the man that I worked for said, "Well, you're a writer, you've got all this writing training, and you know something about animation. Do you want to go over there? And we'll send you over there and pretend you're a client. And, you can see if it's something you're interested in doing." And, well, I needed the money, so I said, "Well, sure, I'll go over there." And I had no idea if I could do it, but I met with Peter Lawrence, who is the head writer, and he was tremendously supportive and tremendously helpful. Again, it became a whole other writing instruction experience. And so, over a period of time, I wrote, I guess, about 25 episodes on four different shows.
So, did you go on from writing animated half hours to stories or to books?
Well, what I did is I had been working in theater, and I had this opportunity to write half-hour animated scripts. So I went and I did that. And again, everything that I had done, sort of just began to all kind of mix together in one bowl. And I started writing the animated cartoons, and I did that over a period of, I guess, about 4 years. And then once production wound down and I was once again looking for work, because I had all these credits in children's entertainment, I went over to the Muppet Company and I wrote short stories for their different character groups, the Fraggles and Muppets and Muppet Babies and some other things. And I worked for Jim Henson Productions on a freelance basis until Jim Henson died very suddenly. And then once again, I was out of work and had never ever thought about writing a book. But my editor at Henson suggested that I go and talk to the people at a publishing company that were working on this book series called Sweet Valley, which I had no idea what that was. And it was, of course, an enormously successful book series for teenage girls. And I would never have tried my hand at writing a book if I hadn't raised the money and didn't know if I could do it or not. But once I sat down to do it, it was remarkably easy because, again, little by little, without knowing it, I had been training in very short forms, longer forms, scene work, half hours, thinking like a director, visualizing, translating complex visual effects into prose, which is what writing for animation is about. And I sat down and, you know, all of the same, you know, principles and techniques that make a narrative work, whether it's in an AABA ballad or, you know, a 275-page novel, the same.
Is it an easy transition going from one type of writing to another in terms of, you know, character development and plot?
It was for me, simply because I had had so much training in craft in those early BMI and ASAP workshops. Because, again, the essential fundamental principles of writing don't change no matter what format you're working in. You have to have characters. You have to know what makes them distinct and different from the other characters. What does each character want? And why do they want it badly enough to, you know, keep enduring one adventure after the other week after week? And sometimes it's just, sometimes you can put them in a, you know, it's just a self-preservation. And sometimes they actually have a goal towards which they're working.
Okay, so how did you first begin writing for Thundercats?
Well, once again, I was working for a company that produced animation, and one of our big clients was Romeo Muller, who was at that time, through the 60s and 70s, had been kind of the premier animation writer in the business. And because he was associated with the company I was working for, when Rankin Bass was looking for animation writers in New York, they called that company and asked them to suggest some writers. And among others, they suggested me. And it was just very lucky break. And I, you know, I had no idea what Thundercats was until I went over there and talked to them, and then discovered it was it. And I'm not sure they were actually had any produced yet at that point. I came in at the end of the first, you know, round of show episodes.
Was there anything that appealed you to write for the show once you saw this cartoon series Thundercats, you know, completely developed?
Well, as a writer, anything that presents new and interesting creative challenges is interesting, and it doesn't really matter what it is, you know, whether it's an animated feature or a short story or a comic book or a novel. As long as it's something new and different and gives you something some interesting problems to solve. And that's what animation was for me. I liked working in the action-adventure area. I mean, that was always a lot of fun. And I liked the writing technique for animation because you're really thinking like a director. I mean, you really have to run it in your head. It becomes less about, you know, the abstractions of words on paper. Is you have to really see what it is you're describing. And so it becomes very vivid and very real to you as you're writing animation. And of course, you're always imagining, you know, the full Disney, you know, animated treatment. And so sometimes, you know, when you see the finished product, it's like, well, that wasn't really what I was visualizing. But nonetheless, you do visualize it always in its fullest and most magnificent, you know, possibility and incarnation. And Peter Lawrence was, again, an excellent writing teacher. And one of the things that he, you know, stressed over and over is there is no reason to use the animated medium unless you're going to use the animated medium. So don't waste the audience's time with action or effects or things that could be just as easily done in live action. You know, make the most of the medium.
So how would you approach writing an episode for the show?
It's pretty much the same process no matter who you're writing for or what, you know, what, whether it's books or a book series or TV series. You usually give them three concepts, you know, a paragraph. Well, four lines, and they look it over and they'll pick one. And because pitch three or four, the chances are two of those have already been done or already in the works or somebody's already suggested them, and for whatever reason they don't work. So you always really want to, you know, present three to four concepts. And then they will generally choose one and then ask you to blow that out into what's called a beat sheet, maybe 10, 12 beats, you know, to show. Are you going to get at least 10 or 12 good and exciting scenes out of this? We want to make sure it's not all talk, it's not talking heads, that it's not static. Are you going to cover a lot of geography? Do you have a narrative arc that's going to hold up? Is it going to be in keeping with the parameters of reality that we have established for this show? And then once your beat sheet is approved, you go from there and you write the script. And then you write a script and they'll send it back for some revisions, or every once in a blue moon they'll just say, that's great, thank you very much, no revisions. And sometimes they'll send it back three times. So, but the goal for everybody is to get a good show that doesn't replicate anything that's been done before, which is very difficult when you're doing 65 and then a second series of 65 and you've gotten a lot of writers on a series. After a while, it gets harder to come up with something that hasn't been done or said or covered.
What was your favorite part about writing the show? Was it dialogue, characters, plot, maybe?
Basically, I liked it because they had a good cross-section of characters with different abilities. And there's just something, let's just say that there's something fundamentally more interesting about feline humanoids than robotic humanoids or fish-type humanoids, which I also worked for Silverhawks and Tiger Sharks. And that were fun series, but they just somehow didn't have the enduring appeal. I think the Lion-O, at the heart of the series, the coming-of-age factor is just something that speaks to everyone, always. It's just a story archetype that we always respond to. And, you know, the man-child with more power than experience that must learn. And that it's and a character that is continually humbled. You know, the infallible, undefeatable superhero is sort of a bore. So I think Lion-O appealed to a lot of fans because I think he's a sympathetic character.
You also worked as a development consultant for Thundercats, Tiger Sharks, and Silverhawks. Can you explain what this role is?
What this is, it sounds very grand, but like most things, it sounds very grand. It's really just putting your butt in the chair and thinking. And when you're doing something like a Thundercats or a Silverhawks, you've got bad guys and you've got good guys, and you've got to come up with situations and goals that are going to sustain all of these characters through 65 episodes. And the basic question is, what do they want? Why are they there? Why are they trying to destroy one another? What's the ultimate goal? And, yeah, you can say, world, you know, I want to own the world. But why? What are you going to do with it once you've got it? That's a lot of grass to mow. So you've got to figure out always what's motivating the characters. And the actual process is usually they pay you some money and you go to a couple of meetings, or maybe you go to lunch, or maybe you just go and sit in your office and come up, just write down all of your thoughts on the topic and hand them in, and then the head writer is going to go through all that material and piece it together and hopefully come up with a strong enough proposal to take you through another 65 episodes.
Now, you also do much public speaking, including a topic about popular culture and curriculum. What are your feelings on this subject?
My feeling is that, and I think that most teachers are on the same page now, but for many years, so many popular culture forms were dismissed as being of little or no value in the development of reading comprehension skills and writing skills. Comic books, anime, graphic novels, cartoons, you know, these were thought to be pretty much a waste of time, you know, a rot your brain activity. But I think that a lot of teachers are getting away from that for a variety of reasons, one of which is that, let's take comic books for a moment. I can tell you as a writer that the hardest work I have ever done was comic books. It was like the parallel parking of storytelling. You know, you have X amount of space, very specific requirements, page to page to page, as to, you know, what you can and can't do. And you've got to get an awful lot of story told in a very small amount of space. And so you learn to be economical as possible with image, with words, with text, and with captions. From a reading standpoint, it is hard to read a comic book or a graphic novel. You have to assimilate a lot of visual information very quickly and figure out how it all fits together. And it's not for the slow-witted. The analogy that I use is that when I pull up to an intersection, say I'm not very visual by nature. I don't care for comic books and things like that. I'm very text oriented. When I pull up to an intersection, I have to look at that sign, and then I have to read that one, and then I have to read that one, and then I have to think about what they all say, and then I make a decision as to which way to turn. But people who can assimilate a lot of visual information quickly, or who are very practiced in doing that, they have read and assimilated all that information before the car even comes to a stop, and they've already reached the decision. So in a lot of ways, it facilitates quicker thinking. And I think reading them is good. I think getting kids to write them is even better. Because if you can think about how popular culture is made, whether it's a cartoon or a comic book or a half-hour TV show, not only are you a better and more discerning consumer of content, you will become a better and more facile communicator and less reliant on long, florid passages of text, which is what we are moving away from. The other story I like to tell is that, you know, I've had this same conversation more than once. I'll be talking to someone about a proposal or a project, and they'll say, that's really great. Can you send me more information? And I'll say, sure, I'll send you the proposal. And they say, no. I just want a page. They're telling me I want more information, but I just want a page. So the job for all of us over the coming decades is to learn to communicate more with less text. And that means we need to learn about pictures, music cues, captioning, you know, how to really work with multimedia and how to accurately convey what we're trying to convey.
Excellent. Now, you're also a custom publishing director. What does this mean?
I work with corporations and nonprofits if they have a particular objective that they want to reach with a publishing program and that there's nothing out there that does exactly what they need done. The same techniques that we use to embed content into entertainment formats. You know, all the Muppet stuff was to some extent very gently didactic. You know, be nice to your neighbors, you know, return things that you borrow. And to the more cynical, you know, buy these toys, you know, buy our action figures. Here's a half-hour cartoon or a two-hour movie designed to sell you tons and tons of plastic stuff. These same techniques that we use to embed message into entertainment formats, we can bring to use with nonprofits and corporations if they want to extend their marketing message or their patient outreach message or their communication or their marketing. And a recent project that I completed was to work with the Child Advocates, Inc. here in Houston, Texas. And what Child Advocates, Inc. Is the Houston chapter of the Court-Appointed Special Advocate System. And that is such a mouthful, and I apologize. It almost sounds like gobbledygook. But these are people who are volunteers, and what they are trained to do is to act as legal guardians ad litem for children who are in foster care or child protective services custody. And it is this hugely bewildering legal labyrinth that is enormously confusing to children, to their parents, to their guardians, and to everyone involved. So we produced 35,000 four-color informational picture books for children, teenagers, and their parents that told a story that embedded in a compelling narrative a lot of the information that they need in order to successfully advocate for themselves in this system or to make sense of what's happening. And so the goals were threefold. One was to give the court-appointed special advocates a communication tool to use with the children that would explain their role, explain what's the difference between the CPS caseworker and your court-appointed special advocate, what's the difference between your attorney and your mom's attorney, who is the judge. When people talk about hearings, what does this mean? In other words, who's making the decisions, what's driving their decisions, and what do they need to know in order to make the best decisions for you? We produced 35,000 books, 5,000 in Spanish, 30,000 in English. Goal one, to provide a communication tool. Goal two was to give them a book that would expand the awareness of what they do with people outside of the system, sort of a marketing and recruiting tool. Would you be interested in being a court-appointed special advocate? Gee, I don't know. What's involved? Well, here, let me give you this book. If I give you a pamphlet, you might crumple it up in the bottom of your purse and ultimately throw it away. If I give you a four-color picture book, you're not going to throw that away. You may not read it, you know, immediately, but you won't throw it away. Books just have a perceived value that a pamphlet does not. And if it's in a compelling narrative, you are going to very quickly understand something that if I gave you a pamphlet with a lot of, you know, blah, 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 your eyes would roll into the back of your head and you'd start snoring. And then, of course, the third goal was fundraising. And they are selling these books in blocks of 100 and 200 books and 300 books to affiliate chapters all over the country and to social services professionals that need them. So that is a custom publishing project. There was nothing out there that filled this need. So they decided to customize this book for their own use and produce it. Custom publishing is very well understood in the commercial area in the use of magazines that are look like consumer magazines, that are conceived as consumer magazines, but where the content is targeted to a specific demographic in order to expand your brand and or your relationship with your customer, but to give them content that is really of value to them and not just what you want them to know about your product.
You also wrote an unproduced script for Thundercats called Goodbye Jaga. I was wondering if you could tell us some information about it, such as plot, character involvement, things like that.
You have to remember this was a long, long time ago. Let's see. I wrote the script, turned it in, was paid for it, and then received a phone call quite a bit later that was quite apologetic, but they decided they didn't want to use that script. They were going to use another script in the series because I think that essentially what I had done was given Lion-O a last hurdle, at which point Jaga would absent himself as a mentor. And I think they decided they really wanted to keep the character or the possibility of bringing the character back in case they ever did another series.
Well, that's really a shame because I think that the later episodes were somewhat lacking and your script sounds pretty good, better than the stuff that they had at the end.
Well, you know what, I shall say nothing. And actually, I don't recall necessarily. Again, there's a certain, when you are in this business, if you want to stay sane and healthy and do a good job, you really do, to a certain extent, check your ego at the door because it is a form of collaboration. It is not necessarily your vision. You invest your ego in doing a good job and not necessarily in doing it your way. And, you know, everybody that, you know, if you've got 14 different writers to come in, you know, without direction and without, you know, sort of insisting that they adhere to the parameters of reality and the characters as they are established, it would be all over the place because everybody would conceive it differently. And that's not to say that somebody might not have a better vision or a different vision, but that's not what the audience is expecting, and the audience would be terribly disappointed.
Is there any particular character you liked writing for?
Well, obviously I liked writing for Chitara, and because, you know, there just aren't that many female action adventure heroes. And I liked writing for Lion-O, and I liked writing for the two kids, and those were probably my three favorites. In fact, my first script that I wrote was about the Wile E. Kit and Wile E. Cat. And that's where I learned to, you know, be very specific in your script writing, because somewhere in that episode, they open a door and a bowl comes running out. And I can tell you that wasn't in the script. So I can only figure that somewhere somebody was working with some sort of literal, you know, Japanese to English dictionary, I think because they did it in Japan. And something must have translated into bowl comes running out of a closet.
Do you know anything about the Thundercats movie that's coming out?
Well, no. Well, only just, you know, a little bit of website news, but I never know what's accurate and what's not. Are they really doing a movie?
Yes, they're doing a Thundercats movie. It's scheduled to be out in 2010, and it's CGI.
What do you think of that?
Well, I'd prefer if they got all the original voice actors together, because I think they delivered a certain passion to the roles that I don't think anyone else will be able to duplicate, in my opinion. It's also good because it's CGI, it's animated, and that's really it.
I just think it would be terrific, and I think, you know, concept lends itself beautifully, high-end animation, and I hope they'll pour a huge amount of money into it and do a really great job. Because I just, you know, it is a, the characters are, as I say, have an enormous appeal that robots do not have. And they also have emotional lives that, they have more intricate, it seems to me, emotional lives than most cartoon characters. Which I think is probably why it has endured. I mean, a lot of things that you watch as a child, you just get a little bit older, you look at it and you think, ugh, what a bore. So I think that people kind of are able to stay fans throughout their lives. You're in college?
Yes, I'm studying radio.
Okay, well, so most of this was being done probably before you were born.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up watching it as a kid.
Well, my first intimation that this had an audience beyond little kids was there was a copy shop across the street from Rankin Bass, and it was Laura Martell Telepictures, but the New York office was Rankin Bass. And so before I would turn in the script, I would always just run up to the copy shop to get a copy made. And, of course, you know, they always had the teenage stoners in there, and like, Thundercats, so cool, you know, we watch that every day. Like, you do? So they clearly had a big fan base beyond little children. But other than that, it's like, how would I know? I'm just a writer. You know, you just write these things your whole life. You go through, you have no idea what in 20 years anybody's going to remember or not remember.
So do you have any fond memories of working on the show?
Well, sure. It was just an exciting thing to be working on anything that was going to be produced and for which they were paying. So it was all very exciting. Yeah, it was just great to be, you know, living in New York, making money as a writer, working for a big entertainment company, and I liked all the people who are associated with it, and they were all just really great and really nice, and it was very collegial, and they were all very talented and extremely helpful to one another. I mean, you know, if something didn't work, they were always ready to, you know, talk with you about a way to make it stronger. And, yeah, it was, and they were always just positive, positive, positive. I really don't have anything negative to say.
Kimberly, thank you very much for taking time to do this interview with me.
Well, thank you, and thank you for remembering, and all of the fans out there, just, you know, keep on watching, and I'll see you at the premiere of the opening, I hope.